Hello, hello. This is Kinnack, also known as Landon Winkler, coming back to you for the 37th Metroplexity podcast, broken out of the, you know, three dozens into the beginning of the fourth dozen, which seems like a lot. So we've got quite a few questions. I had seen Al post his questions, and it's like, oh, that's a decent chunk of questions, but I don't have to worry about that, and became lax in my checking how long the thread had been, so we might have a pretty intense podcast, but I have come prepared with a cup of coffee and a cup of water, so hopefully neither my caffeine stream nor my vocal cords will fail us during this endeavor. There's some other stuff to touch on, but I'm pretty sure that we'll get questions about them anyway, so I'll just go ahead and jump in. First off, we do have a set of questions from Al. Thanks for the podcast and the ramblings, Kinnack. You're welcome. Oh, I should mention that in the podcast crush episode, if you're reading this, listening to this rather, in the future, I have been posting some design-related ramblings to the Metroplexity Games blog at metroplexitygames.com, which you could probably figure out. You are welcome for both the podcast and the ramblings. Status update on things coming up is mid-August, still reasonable guess for Novos. I would say so. It's sort of, you know, in the home stretch. I need to, everything from here on is basically adding content and testing. So there is certainly a possibility for it to release really whenever I want at this point, just based on how much content I had. And then, you know, the final testing pass, which I expect to take a while. I mean, the call Novos what you will, but bereft of complicated interactions, it is not. So there's a lot that has to go into testing that before I can push it out. But yeah, it's one of those things that if I didn't care about bugs or including, you know, sweet hidden stuff, I could push it out like this week, but I do care about both of those things, so it'll still be a bit. 8 of the 13 stories in the Scary Storybook have hidden extra messages that we know of. Do all of them have hidden stuff we can find? Were any added after the fact? I don't believe any of them were added after the fact, although there certainly are times when people will be like, hey, these two things should totally interact, and I'm like, oh god, you're right, those two things should totally interact. With the storybooks, I haven't made a point to get a hidden message in each of the stories, which isn't necessarily to say there isn't one in each of them, but I wouldn't expect that level of parallelism. The name Leandra Silver was mentioned by a blogger on Channel 2 Rachel News back in 2011, and I don't think we've heard of her again. Relation to Silver Towers? Yeah, familial relation. She's part of the Silver family that owns the corporation that owns Silver Towers, along with actually some other stuff that you'll be seeing in not too long. She also is relevant for another reason, which she may not be referenced by name, for the other reason, though. So I can't say for sure, but there's a sort of minor connection of the type that you get with some of the more mysterious figures. Does the Virtual Pet Get Bass minigame have a reward, or is it just something nifty to play with? It's primarily something nifty to play with. It doesn't give you, you know, like a skill or avatar or anything like that at the end. When metal music plays at the happy hour, some new people join the dance floor who look like they just came from a gym by way of an overpriced clothing store. Is there any way to see, meet, fight these people? Seems like we can only steal their trendy caps randomly from the crowd. You know, I should actually make a note to request some art for them, because I would, at least personally, very much enjoy kicking them in the shins. Oh, fair warning, actually, on the art front, art in specific and as sort of a ripple effect. New stuff being pushed out in general might be a little choppy the next couple of months because Puyo has a very good friend from Japan actually coming over here to visit, so a while back she went over to Japan, now her friend is coming over here, so I'm not sure how much time entertaining will be taking up on my side or, you know, on Puyo's side, so it's possible stuff will slow down a bit. Everything like the, you know, donation item for this month and the hacking stuff, unless I find something you know, new that I want to add, all of those are already arted, so if anything that you're actively expecting in the next couple of months gets delayed, it's probably on me. But just like there might be some delays and stuff a little bit further down the road. But we need some bro art. The term chain came out recently, so I don't want to ask too much about it, but a few questions. Was the term chain the item you had planned out a long time ago? Yeah, actually, it's a... It ended up being sort of a merger of two of the earliest item of the month ideas I had designed for Metroplexity. Some of which, you know, have sort of showed up in other places, too. Will SD1s show up more frequently in Old Town? With the change to the first floor spider nest bug, they now seem to be really hard to find. There actually is a not super difficult way to get them repeatedly now. It's just sort of one of those, you know, people haven't necessarily found it yet. Things. But, I mean, there's a whole line of Midgard spider drones, and it's safe to assume that they will be showing up in various capacities, both in Old Town and further down the line. Snapping chains is an oddity. Anything else to discover from the chain while sober? I mean, there's quite a bit of stuff going on with the chain and the techniques. I think the techniques themselves have all been found. But don't quote me on that. I'm pretty sure they have, though. Also, on the topic of snapping chains, you seem to get fewer copies of it the more stealth power you have. Is it supposed to work that way? That is not how that is. Well, pretty sure that's not how that's supposed to work. Yeah, that's the opposite of how that is supposed to work. I will not try to debug that right now. It's sort of trades out with another technique, so it's entirely possible that they're going in the wrong direction. A while back, Will suggested interactions between baseball bats and monstrous pinata. Is there something to look for there? I feel like that did get added in some capacity. Yes. Yeah, I remember actually going through and adding some related stuff there. Stunners incident went in over 4 years ago. We haven't seen more stunners since the item since. Is that something to consider, and will we ever see above slightly improved stun resistance? Actually, I put that in and then more or less forgot that I had put it in between when I pushed it out and when think when it got discovered, or when I noticed it got discovered, or something along those lines. So for quite a while, I wasn't actually aware that, like, I'd obviously known that I'd coded it, but I didn't know that I had put it in. There's actually a lot of stuff like that. There's a ton of code here and there that I've put in to have hooks for and just never ended up having to use. What I would like actually to do before I do anything more with stun resistance is figure out how I want to display it in the actual combat. Because right now, the way that it works is basically just, like, you don't get stunned, but there's no indication that that's what happened, so it's a little weird, using it, like, if, you know, stunning techniques are being used on you, obviously not a big deal, but if it's in, you know, PvP, or, if an enemy of whatever type has stun resistance, then it becomes very strange very quickly. Because, like, he'll try to stun it, and, like, everything will be, you know, lined up to stun, and it just won't happen. I'm not a huge fan of that. So, that's the main hurdle there. Once I figure out how I want that to happen, there will probably be more stun resistance, both, on the player side and on the enemy side. Any hints as to what the strange song technique from Deep Hunter does, other than mysteriously taunt us? I think I'm okay with that one. Thanks, Ganek. You are welcome. A couple questions from Cryptodynamic. Hi, Ganek. Hi, Cryptodynamic. Who or possibly what would you say is your favorite character in the game so far? Well, let's see. For people appearing on screen, it sort of changes over time. Like, I really like, well, Susie, but, Sothrain. But, you know, I've gone through, you know, phases, with a number of different characters. I always kind of come back to Lo, because he's sort of my usual, approach to problems, you know. If you have something weird, just, you know, beat on it with science until it gives up its secrets, which admittedly may or may not be, you know, the best solution when you're faced with the situation that he is, but I have some sympathy for him nonetheless. But yeah, that one changes a lot. The as far as like people who have been mentioned, probably Lo's old boss, when he was working in special projects, and that's a pretty consistent one. There's a lot of getting into his head that I've had to do that doesn't unstick very easily. Can you have a hint about some secret we haven't discovered about that character? Well, let's see. Well, the first one I listed, I think people found out basically everything about Sothrain. Probably the biggest secret is that I should remember at some point to put a option in her choice encounter to talk to her about Yggdrasil, which won't give you any remotely useful information. It's just something that you should be able to do, because actually, you know, I don't think she actually directly mentions Yggdrasil. Okay, that's, haha. I was like, why didn't I do that?
Right.
Because she mentions the game that was on Yggdrasil, and I don't think she mentions it by name. Anyway. I don't think that there's anything further to discover with her, like, in-game, per se. I mean, there's some stuff that she says that has some interesting bearings on, you know, the sort of the nature of the museum and how people, you know, other than the PC, interact with the museum, which is pretty cool. But that's more on the, like, you know, story side of things than the mechanical secrets. For Lowe's boss, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that hooks into him. The most, probably the biggest one, just being what all actually hooks into him. There's a lot of stuff going on there. But again, not really a mechanical thing, per se. Just a story question. On the topic of people that I really like, I also really appreciate Hel. She just I don't typically allow myself a lot of just like you know, complete badasses, and she is definitely one of them, which doesn't come up a ton in the storyline because she's so fucking paranoid, but not a easy person to cross blades with, as it were. Is it currently possible to find a polysteel extruder or a temperer anywhere? No, you'll more advanced types of polysteel will show up, but polysteel is used in a lot of different ways, and more advanced polysteel stuff will show up more in like Old Town, Downtown, places like that. Some questions from Magnifico. In this incarnation, I've spent many days in much body getting all, the messages from Shaman's Brew. I'm a little afraid to reset for fear of having gotten close to unlocking something cool but not making it all the way. Should I be worried about this? I wouldn't. I mean, sometimes you just have to, you know, take a leap. And, I mean, for all you know, there's something cool that happens if you, you know, had seen all of them in a previous incarnation, right? I mean, there's... I would like to say I'm not that evil, but that would be a lie. So, you know. Damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Is there more to the insect collection that we can find out? The tantalizing hints about connections to drones foreshadowing for the future. Is there stuff to find now? How hidden is it? There's a lot of stuff, I guess, obviously there are a lot of secrets in the game, shock and awe, I know. A lot of them, sort of like what I was talking before with my favorite characters, a lot of them are mechanical, but just as many, if not more, are actually, story things. So the connection there isn't a mechanical thing, at least at this point. But there is a bit of a mystery snaking around there. Is there any way to make the form of change show up in a reasonably predictable way? I'm having a devil of a time trying to get unlocked chain. It's frustrating to spend a whole day's turn and not see it even once. It is... pretty predictable if you are doing it, quote unquote, right. This is me double checking to make sure that I'm not a terrible person. I'm not going to be able to find the code that does that immediately, but it's not super hard, I don't think. No. Through the magic of complaining about stuff publicly, I now have unlocked chain. Are there more charmed chain techniques, detached items we have yet to find? I don't believe so. I would have to double check the list. But I think people probably have everything. There's nothing that's incredibly well hidden as far as the techniques themselves go. Some questions from Arcane. I don't know about you, Kinect, but I miss those days of 2-hour-plus podcasts, so I'm going to try to bring those days back, even if I have to do it single-handedly. And you know me when I set these kind of challenges on myself. Look out! It looks like you are... Let's see, you've got an hour and 40 minutes to fill, I guess, with Dr. Zombie and, wow, and more of yourself and Volma. Okay, You might have me at this one. And I hope you don't make the podcast on the day I make this post. I'm going to need at least another day to really beef this up. Otherwise, boy, will my face be red. Question one. Do you miss those days of 2-hour-plus podcasts? It is nice to have sort of a... long conversation, if you will, and I'm glad that people are, like, you know, excited and have a bunch of questions. My throat does tend to get pretty raw after talking for 2 hours, but there are prices you must pay. There was a bug before and killed the annoying museum volunteer with the yellow-laced garrote. Security would not get mad. Apparently that was a bug. It seems so random and specific, I have a hard time imagining how a bug like that could happen. Could you explain the anatomy of a really weird bug like that? Let me... think. There are times when, I don't recall if this is the exact cause for it, but there will be issues where, let's say I have, script that runs at the end of combat. There are a couple places where if I try to set another script to run at the end of combat, it'll overwrite the first one. Or, like, if I'm tagging, you know, putting a flag on the account to say that something happened, and then proceed to you know, set it so that another flag is set, they'll sort of run into each other and explosions. Which, in that case, I'm not 100% sure that that's actually what caused that one, because it was a while back, but what ends up causing that sort of situation is the same part of the rewarding stuff at the end of combat code that makes sure that all of the items are grouped together appropriately, so you don't get, like, you know, each item listed out individually in sort of a random order, that it groups the items together. That has some weird side effects on non-item code sometimes. And it's sort of a... It's like there's a lot of things that do have to be grouped that way, like the items, the techs, techniques, I should say, the credits obviously have to be grouped slightly differently, but sort of the same way. But then there's stuff that doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense, like scripts, like putting, you know, two scripts together will not necessarily be the sum of its parts. So yeah, it's just, like a lot of things, the more you try to, get things to work perfectly, like, you know, the harder you grip your hand, the more sand slips through your fingers. And there are definitely some things that, deserve, you know, a going through and entirely rewriting. That one not necessarily being one of them, I just have to be careful, that each type of reward is handled separately and correctly. Based on the vigilante recording, we just barely missed the guy. I mean, he was strolling around South Stride, which we cleaned up. Damn shame. Any chance we'll get a meeting of the ghost of the vigilante, like how the ghost of the psychopath showed up as the quad psycho? It's not outside the realm of possibility. It has a little bit to do with how... what specters are and how they're formed and things like that, which I guess is all the answer you're about to get. But it wouldn't be completely outside the realm of possibility to meet the specter of the vigilante. On a similar vein to the above question, why do these etheric manifestations tend to, at the very least, have a sinister streak to them? Why no avatars of truth and justice busting forth from the heads of eclipse heads? Busting forth from the heads of eclipse heads. Okay, I was just like, wait, did I read that wrong? That has... a lot, I think, to do with... both how you're meeting people and sort of the tone of the, you know, those manifestations, like the actual other people's dreams that you're walking into, so to speak. There are definitely some eclipse manifestations that are more or less benevolent. I mean, obviously you meet the mushroom people, and they're fine. Depending on your exact outlook, arguments could be made for the fish off the docks or the fae. I would... personally tend towards the fish ethically, but, you know, obviously those sorts of questions can go many different ways. And a lot of them are more or less just territorial. Part of the other reason behind it is just that if you meet an etheric manifestation that isn't obviously inhuman. I mean, for example, the quant psycho is not, I mean, is creepy, but isn't, like, if you met him on the street, he looks human enough, right? So if you're not throwing down so to speak. There is no necessary way to know for sure if, you know, he's an etheric manifestation until you're, you know, well into the combat. So, I mean, any random person you meet on the street might be. And obviously, I think that, you know, if you sort of go through, you know, what's going on there, to the best of your knowledge, you can safely assume that a lot of them aren't. But any sort of non-aggressive manifestation is very likely to just, I mean, not bother you, right? Although, I mean, some of them you do sort of piss off through the nature of things, but I think that answers the question. In that there are a couple of different answers. I think that if you were to look globally, well, globally is a bad term there, but if you were to look throughout all of the etheric manifestations that exist, I would guess that the majority of them are pretty creepy. But the question of, you know, how many of the ones that you meet are actually, you know, noteworthy, ends up being, you know, a lot more important. Like, you know, there are probably some, well, I mean, things like in Lake Metroplex, when you're on the investigating the palace down there, things like that, there's a lot of stuff living down there, right, that isn't actually, you know, alive, right, like isn't there through any sort of naturalistic means. And yeah, like, you fight, you know, the sharks and the octopus and the various and sundry fish folk. But, you know, the seaweed isn't there naturally either. You could very easily argue that, you know, the rocks and sand, the palace itself, the statues, the urns, that all of these things, you know, the giant fucking oysters, which are, you know, basically non-violent, right, oysters, that they're not, that yes, you know, you mostly end up dealing with the more, you know, mobile and violent, manifestations, but there's a lot of that is because they're mobile and violent, not because they're actually the majority. On a speedy note, a long while back, you said we got one half the puzzle to figuring out the toxic crystal, venomous angel, and toxic octopus eye trio of items. I still haven't figured out what that one half of what we figured out was. Was that supposed to be part of the puzzle? If not, mind enlightening us? If it is, hint. I seem to recall that actually the question included that. The question itself had the information buried in it, but that was, as you said, a long while back, with three O's. Possibly. There is, I guess, the interaction there is mostly with a technique that doesn't come up much. So I guess that'll be your hint. I've toyed with some serious ash for a while, and as far as I've got is to get my guy to recognize the patterns as old drone neural nets when he takes the dust sober. Is there any way to progress the sober requests further? Good old mysterious ash. I mean, there are definitely some other results you can get while sober. That is the end of one train of thought, though, as it were. On the etheric side of a serious ash, always have forgotten the guy to say about it, so that reminds him of the slice. Is there a way to progress the etheric side of the serious ash as well? How hard is it? That is the end of that chain, but there's actually some stuff earlier. Is there a point of sober in the etheric sides of the results of the shit-ass intersex pursuit? Amazing rewards beyond imagination! I mean, there's some cool stuff that it does, but you've probably figured out, at least for the two chains that you're talking about, what they do in addition to giving the messages. There's some other cool stuff that it does, but those are those messages are I think you're fine on those. Why do the swarming insects of the Army Museum never show up when I'm swarming with spiders and carrying a spider nest? Are they afraid of arachnids? You could in fact say that they have arachnophobia. If I ever actually saw that movie, I would make some sort of cunning reference here. But instead, I'll just reference the fact that there is, in fact, a movie called Arachnophobia. Speaking of the Air Museum, Susie! Hi! We were talking about Susie earlier. She says, no, but we all know that she really wants the E. What would happen if she takes Eclipse? What would she see? Or would nothing really special happen, like with most people? I would... Anyone who actually... reacts with Eclipse quote properly in the way that the PCs do or on a related vein, I would generally suggest not doing that where Susie normally hangs out. There's a little bit about that in some of her new text about the docents. In that, like, even the serious Eclipse heads don't usually take Eclipse in the museum, because it's a terrible idea. In general, I would imagine that it would end up being moderately spectacular, so don't feed Susie Eclipse after midnight. On the same vein as above, there's another suspicious girl on the dance floor in the happy hour. I mean, she's even got a Novos result dedicated to her. Whenever I try to get in a dance off with her, I get the dance dance skill. All that she ever does is try to punch me in the face. Is there more to her than meets the eye? I'm just on 80s kick right now. I don't know what happened. I blame arachnophobia, which, for all the good I do, is probably not even in the 80s. By the way, it is totally off topic. But Puyo, so my spouse Liz, Puyo, and I are all big Transformers fans, from way back to, you know, the present-ish. And so we have gone to see the Michael Bay movies, and sort of setting aside the sort of personal insult that was the second movie, in not in that like, oh god, they're, you know, raping my childhood or anything, but in the like, you think that I, as like, you know, your target audience for this, will laugh at all of your stupid racist jokes. Not really okay with that. Anyway, so setting that aside, we've been like, okay, well, I mean, it's basically, you know, we get giant transforming robots, and that's it, really. I mean, there's, like, no other redeeming features going on, and, like, a lot of the stuff that, I mean, even, like, can barely even say that it's really, like, Transformers in a lot of ways, but at least, you know, we get giant transforming robots. And, you know, Bay can do a special effects extravaganza when he feels like it, and bothers to, you know, frame his shots with the special effects in mind rather than just taking a pretty picture and throwing some CGI on it without thinking. Anyway, all of that's actually just prelude to the story that I wanted to talk, because I find it amusing. So Liz and I still haven't gone to see the fourth one, and but Puyo went to see it more or less when it came out, and you know, went back to work and was like, oh, that, you know, that was not, like, good by any means, but it was fine. And, you know, giant transforming robots, sort of, you know, like all of us have said up to this point. And one of the women who she works with went to go see it and came back and was like, you thought that that movie was not one of the worst things you have ever seen. If I did not know you so well and were not really good friends with you, I would just stop talking to you for not thinking that that is one of the worst movies ever. And I'm like, wow. So, I don't actually have any personal opinion on it. I just think it's like, that level of response just makes me kind of happy. Anyway, the dance skill. Now, at present, there are no ways to woo or learn the dance skill from her. It's not just the dance skill. It seems suspiciously absent. This is the next question, by the way. I was not actually trying to set this up. Skill in swords is also suspiciously missing. There are tons and tons of swords and tons of interactions all over Metroplexity. But it is the far more niche and reclusive chains that get the skill. Two, if you count the charm chain, what do you think of this discrepancy? Actually, I have a giant block of sword-related content that I'll be putting in at some point. So yes, that is very suspicious. There's a... at some point I'll be sort of doing a revamp of the Ghost Ship. And that includes some piratiness, which tends to include swords. We found in the sights. Anything else big like that hiding from when you updated the guns and long-range combat? I mean, there definitely was at least one technique that I updated that, like, nobody noticed for weeks and weeks at least. Which was a little weird. May still be unnoticed. I'm not actually 100% sure. I think that was the last big thing with that. There are definitely some minor interactions with techniques that I haven't found, though. Intermission! Con season has been going on recently. Tons of cons last month. Have you been to any cons recently? What are your con experiences like? Met any Metroplexians at con? What were they like? Let's see. Alright, let's take these one at a time. Been to any cons recently? No. I went to DC a while back, obviously not for con stuff. Liz has been going to a lot of cons, but not for, like, gaming things. We're definitely gearing up for Gen Con, though. Liz and another person from our gaming group are working on Pathfinder costumes. Liz is going as Sione, and another person is going as Fea, if those mean anything to you. If you search for Pathfinder Sorcerer and Pathfinder Witch, you will probably see them, like the characters that they're going as. The Gen Con is definitely always our big con for the year. Origins is, like, within walking distance, but we just never seem to end up going, which sounds dumb, is kind of dumb, but you'll have that. What we did find recently, though, and by find recently, I mean found out months ago and finally got off our asses to check out, is that there is, also within walking distance, about, you know, halfway to where Origins is, so easy walk, is a place called Kingmakers, which is a, basically a board game parlor. You pay, it's like a $5 cover, and basically, like, sit around and get to use all of their board games for as long as you want. Everything, you know, from Connect Four and Rock'em Sock'em Robots through, like, like an entire, like, bookcase for just, like, you know, Catans and Dominions through, like, we played, I think it's called Kingdom Builder, which was very good. Sort of, very replayable, well-designed game. And we played, game where you're trying to escape from the temple and there's an actual timer, and hated it with Passion of a Thousand Fiery Suns, but I could see enjoying it. It was just sort of like, oh, this is not my thing. I think that I actually called Escape. But anyway, really cool. So yeah, you can go there and have, like, your play games for however many hours you feel like playing games, basically, and have a bar with a bunch of, you know, craft beers and ciders and local meads and all of these things. And apparently snacks, too. We didn't try the snacks at all, but the ciders were very good. And we live in, like, hipster central, so they, of course, came out in mason jars for us, which, as much as I will totally make fun of places for serving drinks in mason jars for being super hipster, I will say that when you're drinking and, like, you know, the board game there, really the wider the base of your cup, the better. So I will take a mason jar over, like, a more traditional, you know, glass that narrows towards the bottom, because that shit's so much easier to knock over and spill over all the games. So I will forgive them the mason jars. Super cool local business. Don't take cash at all, because fuck cash. I know, it was a lot of fun. The reason I was thinking about that, because cons, when Origins was going on, they had a sign up front that was like, welcome Origins attendees, you know, because Origins is huge board gaming. I mean, it technically has, you know, RPGs and everything else, but it's mostly a board gaming thing. What are your con experiences like? Well, Gen Con is pretty much our big, couple vacation every year. So I guess for those not in, like, the, you know, tabletop, RPG, what have you world, Gen Con is a con that a very long time ago, like before D&D was a thing, was in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. So Geneva Convention, Gen Con. It was a wargaming convention at first, so Geneva Convention is just, I personally think, a hilarious pun. Anyway, by the time, like, I was born, it had been moved to Milwaukee at a center called Mecca, which is also fairly funny, because it, by this point, was the, sort of holy land for, you know, tabletop RPG players. So, you know, you take your yearly pilgrimage to Mecca, which is, you know, probably culturally insensitive, but pretty funny. And so, Milwaukee, not, like, awesome about being either welcoming or having enough hotels for people. And they would just, like, you know, thousands of geeks flood their downtown, and they'd just be sort of like, really? What the fuck are you people doing here? Rather than, like, the not completely moronic response, which is, oh, look, a ton of people here to spend money, many of which, like, are, you know, engineers and shit. Even, I mean, back then, this was before, like, you know, they were all computer programmers, but, you know, engineers and shit, who have more than enough money to spend, you know, like, let's do our bare minimum of due diligence to, you know, separate these people from their money. But, yeah, it's Milwaukee. It's just it never quite settled in for Milwaukee. But anyway, so the, Liz and I, basically every year since we started dating, with one exception, the first year we went, it was actually still in Gen Con, and then we missed the first year that it moved to Indianapolis, and have been every year since. So, I mean, that's a lot of Gen Cons. When we're there, we usually, we try to get a hotel nearby, but that was a freaking nightmare the past couple of years. So we're not actually nearby this time, unfortunately. But we go and we see our friends who we basically only see at Gen Con, which are good folks, but, you know, not, you know, in Columbus normally. And we, let's see, the first years I was there, I went to a lot of game design seminars, particularly with Jared Sorensen and Luke Crane. Yes, I remember their names. I'm usually really bad with that. Who are both really solid designers with very different design styles, who used to do sort of a... It came across as kind of, you know, odd couple-y, almost, like, you know. So you have, like, these two very different styles, but both of them are very, like, no-nonsense if, like, something is just a terrible idea. Like, it was actually very much, if something was just a terrible idea, Luke would just be like, that's a terrible idea. And Jared would be like, you could probably fix it by doing this. Or, like, you know, you should really focus on sort of, like, your, you know, core competencies, basically. Anyway, amazing this set of seminars. And got to, occasionally they'd rope in someone else, like John Wick, who did L5R, things like that. That was a particularly good one. But, I mean, after you go to, you know, all of the game design seminars for, like, you know, 4 or 5 years, they eventually become very samey. And you've sort of absorbed what you can. So now the last couple of years, we've basically been hitting up all of the Paizo seminars, or at least, you know, better than half of them, all the ones that that interest us. So learning about what's, you know, up and coming with Pathfinder. And anyone who is going to Gen Con, for what it's worth, even if you give no fucks about Pathfinder, I would strongly suggest going to the Emerald Spires All-Stars, Emerald Spire All-Stars seminar, because that's, they did a big project as part of a Kickstarter to put together a mega dungeon, and they had all of these, like, big names in gaming each do a level of the dungeon, so there's like 60 and 70 levels, something like that. This actually got to edit some of them, which is very cool. But a lot of the, I mean, it's a lot of the people working on it are, I mean, like Ed Greenwood, who did the Forgotten Realms, Chris Promise, who's the head of Green Ronin, but also like Lisa Stevens, who is the CEO of Paizo, but who also was like the first employee at Wizards of the Coast, and worked at White Wolf back in the day as well. So like, it is like huge like arc of life and like gaming history. But Frank Mentzer, who is not a super well-known name, like I feel like even within tabletop RPGing, but wrote what is widely considered the best of the original D&D boxed sets. As a disclaimer, I'm totally biased because it's actually the one that got me into gaming originally. So if you're like, oh, you know, why does Kinnack have like all these weird ideas and, you know, this bizarre role-playing-esque online game, you can totally blame that on indirectly, I guess, on Frank Mentzer. But anyway, really cool seminar. They did one last year, sort of as a preview, and then Emerald Spiral actually be out, or is out. And so they're going to do, obviously, a little bit more in-depth this time, I would guess. It's a really cool group of people to get to listen to. The other one's actually really good is Auntie Lisa's Story Hour, which is Lisa Stevens, who, I'm not sure if I said out loud, but she's CEO of Paizo, along with having been employee when I want to see, and having worked at White Wolf, and so on and so forth. And that's just her, like, basically, like, reminiscing and shooting the shit with the audience, and, like, telling stories from back in the day, which is insane, as far as, like, just the, like, how the industry has worked and changed, and, like, the stuff that people fought through to get, you know, various games out to market. And, like, things like being involved in, like, you know, the meetings that led to Magic the Gathering being a thing. Getting, you know, sued by TSR that was in the early days of WotC before they released Magic. And then over the course of, you know, the next couple of years, like, growing and eclipsing TSR, and TSR, you know, sort of falling apart due to complete mismanagement, and then, like, heading up the team, like, buying them out and taking them over. It's just, from a gaming history perspective, it's incredible. Like, there are a few better ways to spend an hour if you have any interest at all in gaming history. Anyway, Gen Con, we go to a bunch of Paizo stuff, and we, gone to True Dungeon basically every year that it's been out. It's like, I think we've missed two, killed a lot of things, gotten killed pretty much just once by the big fuck-off dragon, which is what you do. I mean, you take on the huge red dragon with the animatronics and, you know, piles of treasure, and you just get annihilated. That's how that works. True Dungeon, also very cool, if you have a chance. It's become much easier to get tickets for. They've really ramped up their availability so that people who want to run it can actually run it, as opposed to all of the tickets disappearing basically the day of. Actually, for a while it was like you had like 5 minutes to get a ticket or you were just not going to get one that year. Thankfully, that's mostly sorted itself out now. It's you have 5 minutes to get a hotel downtown. Otherwise, you're just effed. Which, sadly, is not not an easy thing to fix. Let's see. Met any reflections at Con? Yeah. I met Glass and Shard when we were doing a con called Con on the Cob here in Ohio. They were both very cool. Actually, it was really very funny. Glass I met also at Gen Con, I believe, before that. Shard, we were talking, and I was like, you look super familiar. She's like, yeah, you look super familiar, too. And we were, we'd sort of gotten off that, or we're shooting the shit about something else, and it was myself, Liz, and Puyo, and Puyo was talking about how at that time she still lived in Peoria, and Shark was like, no shit, I totally used to live in Peoria. And we were like, oh, well, that totally has to be, you know, where we've seen each other. And she's like, oh, yeah, I went to school at Bradley. It's like, I totally went to school at Bradley. She's like, oh, wait a second. Like, you're the guy in Williams Hall who was always sitting in the lounge, like, reading quantum physics books for no reason. I'm like, you are totally the girl who's always wandering around wearing pajama pants in, like, the middle of the night. And we were like, oh my god, we totally know each other. It was very weird. Anyway, there's actually a podcast with the two of them from the Con on the Cob room. That was a lot of fun. Anyway, that was a good time. And at a random Gen Con, I was wearing a Metroplexity shirt, and we were sitting having lunch in the food court of the mall, which is the you know, the place to have lunch if you want something quick. And a guy was walking by me, and he was like, sweet, Metroplexity, I totally love that game. I didn't know you could get t-shirts for it. I was like, oh, yeah, you can, you know, get them from Cafe Press. I'm not sure if the link's even still up. But I only have this one because I needed to, you know, test the order system. He's like, what? And it's like, oh, yeah, I'm totally, you know, the lead developer. He's like, sweet, awesome game, thank you so much. And then, you know, of course, had somewhere else to be, but it was awesome. Glad to. Always nice to meet people. Very cool. Everyone who I've met in association with the game has been super awesome. Alright, moving on to some questions from Dr. Zombie before we apparently get back to Arcane. In a previous podcast, you mentioned that a Wolfman avatar was available. Naturally, you're scrambled to find it and failed. Perhaps you can tell me which one of the following methods was closest to correct while still being wrong, because I did not get the avatar. I did the following things. Used Call of the Moon following each of the Moon Tides in a single combat. Huge pain in the butt. Used Call of the Moon following each of the Moon Tides in order from 0... Skin of the Wolf to 4, Full Moontide, in sequential combats, not necessarily the very next combat each time, but not using that combination of skills, 5-6, in any combat unless it fit the sequence. Doing both of the above during an actual full moon, on Friday the 13th, no less, June 13th, 2014, that is sweet as hell. I unfortunately do not have anything to check the actual moon phases in Metroplexity, but I totally should. Wearing a ton of wolf-like gear and winning combats, completing a full moon tide cycle back to 0 in a single combat, having one of each of the moon tide cycle in the action list in a single round. Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4 moon tide phases and a fifth item, which happened to be a Call of the Moon. Agony, but I did it once or twice. So yes, which of these is closest to correct, or are they all so far away from correct that I should wipe out the whiteboard and start from scratch? Let me see. I would say probably completing a full moon tide cycle back to 0 in a single combat is the closest. None of them is particularly close, though. Secondly, a question which was asked a long time ago and answer given, but deserves a rethink. Is there a way to complete the initial Eclipse Southside quest by joining the Fangs? Is there a plan to implement such, if not? You can obviously, you know, talk to Carlos and he'll give you some Eclipse. there's not a currently a way to flat out join the Fangs, no. That'd be cool. I would like to have just a ton of paths through the game. I'm more focused on the moment at moving forward. Maybe once I get Old Town out. Insofar as the what would probably have to happen with something like that is you'd obviously have to replace the, I mean, there'd be a new version of the Southside quest, which would not take that long, but there'd also basically have to be a new version of the Docks quest to have you run through it as a Fang, right? So, I mean, that would probably end up being more or less entirely different, which would be a pretty big deal. So, I don't have any specific plans for that, but it would not surprise me to see that show up at some point. Let me actually... Alright, I'm actually going to pause for a moment, and we'll be back with more questions from Arcane. Okay, I return. That is an awesome idea. I should pause more often, but I'm always afraid I'm going to, you know, break the podcast. Back with Arcane. Haha! I bet you thought you're through with me, but lo, this is my actual, more ultimate form! I remember in our correspondence you told me I misunderstood the art museum puzzle as having the vertical and horizontal cycles aligned. Turns out it only has a horizontal cycle, but in your deepest imaginings, Kinnack, do you imagine a puzzle that covers great swaths of metroplexity where a beautiful yet terrifying symmetry of horizontal and vertical, dare I even say diagonal, cycles converge to reveal the ultimate truth? And why restrict cycles to Euclidean in space? Gotta think outside the Tesseract. I'm actually kind of thinking about now whether Tesseract is technically Euclidean space. Like, does Euclidean space necessarily require three dimensions? I feel like it doesn't. At the very least, you can have, like, a two-dimensional Euclidean space. But anyway, yes, warped space-time, yes. Anyway, I mean, there definitely are most of the puzzles that are, like, huge, right? That, like, get touched in tons of locations and, like, weave through the entire game are more story-based mysteries than, you know, puzzles. Like, puzzles that necessarily, like, you get them right and the game even tells you, right? Which, of course, means that the largest, hardest puzzles in the game are made even harder because you will never know if you have the right answer or not. Which I think officially makes me a terrible, terrible human being. But yes, the idea of having a massive puzzle embedded in the fabric of the game itself does appeal to me. major ups to Al's suggestion, the column lengths and hiding images ability. It's like 100 times easier to play Metroplexity on the phone now. Woo, go Al! The thought of waiting each and every time I equipped and unequipped something for the entire inventory fresh on my phone. No! So this is much better, but I wonder, could it be even better? Thoughts on making an app for Metroplexity? Actually, that is something that has been much on my mind of late. I have taken the first terrifying step and started to play around with Xcode, which is the development package that you use to make iPhone apps. At present, if I were going to make an app, the first one would almost assuredly be iPhone, because that's what I have. So there wouldn't really be any way at present for me to test a Droid app. Which, like, it's one of those things where you're sitting and you're thinking, and you're like, oh man, which one should I try to, like, learn and do first? And it's like, you know, I can't actually tell if I've completely fucked up with the Droid app. Like, obviously you can simulate both of them. At least I assume you can simulate Droid apps, but there's like an iPhone simulator built into Xcode, which is very nice. But like, that's not actually the same thing as running it on a real piece of hardware. So it's sort of like, well, okay, there's no way that I can actually really debug a Droid app at this point, so I'd better just do iPhone first. But yes, so I've been playing around with Xcode some, and actually one of my action items, as they were for this week, is to start looking into exactly how you go into building web apps, which are probably what you'll end up having here. It's just it's basically a specialized portal to a website. So you could have, the little Eclipse logo on your phone, and you click it, and it brings up Metroplexity, but Metroplexity formatted such that, you know, it works on a phone, and, like, you can slide things and all that happy stuff. But yeah, that, as I said, is something that is much on my mind. It's a pretty major undertaking, both because I need to, learn a bunch of stuff, but also because once I do learn a bunch of stuff, there's almost assuredly going to be, like, major underpinning, like, not necessarily, like, code changes, but, like, markup changes, like a lot of, you know, HTML and CSS stuff changing, and that will be pretty serious undertaking. But I would like to, at some point, have apps for both Metroplexity and Twilight Heroes, and in the distant future, to have a Droid phone, so that I can also test them for on Droid and get it launched over there as well. So yeah, it is actually something that is far more in progress than it has been in the past, just as of the last few weeks. But I will promise that it will be a while. So it's like the exact opposite of a promise that it'll be done soon. I can promise that it won't be done soon. So you had goals when you first started out making Metroplexity, playing between help desk calls, and hey, phones are a much bigger part of work lag time now. What are your goals for it now? What I really want Metroplexity to be when it's, you know, quote, done, which is not, like, there's done and then there's done, right? Like, we'll say, I don't call the game beta anymore, really, but if we say, if we were in beta, like the release version, as opposed to, like, the expansions, which are whatever comes later, right? Once the game becomes feature complete. There we go. What I would like that to look like is a environment where you can make more or less any choices you want. Like, obviously, like, if you just choose to sit and dick around, like, you won't finish the game, right? Like, not saying that, you know, you can get to the end through any means you want necessarily, but that there are options there for mean everything from, joining the Fangs, like we were just talking about, to, going on a murderous rampage, to, going through the entire run without killing anyone, which you obviously can do, but with the complete game, the little smaller choices that you make with every encounter. Like, I really want that to be a deep well of options. My favorite memory of playing Planescape Torment, which is one of the sort of inspirations for Metroplexity, is there is an encounter, well, not really even an encounter, there's a point where you run into this sort of kinetic sculpture, I guess you would say, that's just like this pillar of like shards of ice that are spinning around. It's very pretty. But when you interact with it, if you bought this, ever frosty mug, which is totally a D&D magical item for what it's worth, that I'm sure that they thought was hilarious and so included in the game. If you bought the ever frosty mug from the vendor across Sigil, you could actually use it to catch one of the shards of ice and keep it cold, and so you just have the shard of ice that comes in handy later. But I mean that follows. But I had, grabbed the mug because I figured it might come in handy, and went up to interact with this sculpture. And with the option, catch, one of the shards in the mug, I was like, wow, that's a really good idea. I just, would not have thought of that. And I want those sorts of things, right? I want there to be so many options that, the stuff that you want to do is there, and some stuff that you're kind of like, oh, yeah, I guess I could do that, is also there. That's sort of end goal. The other half of that is, we can go through and layer in that sort of texture, but the story arc of the game isn't finished, so we want all of those things textured through this whole arc. And so once it's done, which obviously, this is a long-term vision, it will look a lot like a GM-less role-playing game. That's one of the other goals that I originally had, and one that I still very much strive towards. Really want that level of texture and interaction. And that means both, all of these options, and all of the things that are sort of hidden options, almost, like the puzzles and so forth, that, you can trigger things that you might not have necessarily, that might not necessarily show up as, an option in a choice encounter, but, if you fire off, two the rockets right in a row, you get a special encounter, those things. There's that sort of big vision. I would also like people to be able to play on phones. That was not part of the vision when the game first started, for obvious reasons. But it's definitely something that I would like to see. And just lots of other little things. The big goal is basically the bringing sort of a... I'm trying to remember the quote. If I recall correctly, it's about 4th edition D&D, but This could be applied, actually, to a lot of different tabletop role-playing games. If we could just put the designer in a box and send him out with copies of this game, everyone would love it. And I think... Actually, it might have been applied to Jonathan Tweet twice, now that I think about it. Because I seem to recall someone saying about that. With one of his earlier designs. But also with the fourth. But anyway. Regardless. Or third. It doesn't matter. So, sort of the... I have, you know, this way that I GM, which is very... very much encapsulated in Metroplexity. These sort of, like, layers of mysteries that are fundamentally solvable, like the actual, you know, content mysteries, the rules, the mechanical mysteries that we were talking about, which, I mean, in a tabletop setting are less distinguishable from the second category, which are, you know, the story mysteries. But if you play in one of my games, and Liz hates this, which is funny, but they're sort of the sort of day-to-day, session-to-session mysteries that, you know, you sort of investigate and figure out and knock out. But they're also part of these more overarching meta plot almost, where the answers aren't necessarily forthcoming. Even if you learn, you know, the origins of humanity, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're right, like you can't actually verify it. Also doesn't necessarily matter. Like in a actionable sense. So these sort of mysteries embedded in a firmament of larger scale, almost like existential isn't really quite the right word, but almost philosophical mysteries. And I want to sort of be able to share that, both because I think that it's a lot of fun to play through those games, and because there's a lot to be said for tabletop role-playing that... computer games as a whole aren't actually very good at capturing, and I think that the Metroplexity model is actually pretty good at capturing it. By no means perfect, but a damn sight closer than a lot of other types of games. So that's sort of been part of the big vision from day one, is just become a more and more prominent part as we've gone on. And who's the best spader? Clearly whoever is listening to this podcast right now. Unearthly items time. It's hard to use the diviner times because it can easily take 20 plus energy to get one drop from the pants. It takes at least two of these items to make it consumable, and as an unearthly item almost entirely on its consumable, it makes it a huge commitment to use. Is there any way to speed up the frequency of the item drops? I want to say that there is. Yes, there indeed is. I'm not sure if you would find that more or less annoying than just taking your time, though. Why does the Serpent of the Earth act all confused when you strike your selection of the techniques? Is that hinting towards something bigger when you strike your selection of techniques? I'm not actually sure what you mean by striking your selection of techniques. The Serpent of the Earth has what is figured to be a really rare drop, the Tear of the Earth. Yet Velma said he's able to get a number of these things in short order. Is it actually rare, or does it have a specific set of conditions in order to be yielded? There are very, very few drops in the game that are just rare. Some of them... I'm only actually thinking of one. Has a bunch of requirements and is rare, because I am a dick. But basically every other item is just has conditionals on it. I would have to look up that specific one to know what the percentile chance is. What I can say is that the danger of spading any sort of, you know, partially random occurrence is that you will get streaks of good and bad even without, you know, anything affecting it because of the nature of probability. So it wouldn't surprise me if that were uncommon. It's possible we're talking past each other because I would think of a rare drop as being like, say, less than 3%. So it's entirely possible that, you know, it's a 5 or 10% or whatever. The Writhing Fungus has a technique that drags you off your feet and at the end of the round drops you to the ground for significant damage. But at one point I could have sworn I was able to just completely avoid the end of round damage. It just didn't happen. I have combat logs of that, yet I failed time and again to replicate it. Some bizarre buggers, there's actually some way to completely avoid the fall damage. Knowing me, that is the sort of thing that I would totally code in a way to do. Because that is how I roll. I would imagine there's a way to at least avoid getting dragged off your feet. There we go. Assuming it's the code I think it is, there isn't any immediately obvious way to avoid all of the damage. Unless there's somewhere to avoid getting dragged off your feet in the first place. We can check over those logs sometimes if you want. There are two techniques from the Scuffed Mining Helmet. Pale Summons and Mining Strike. This seems astonishingly small. Is there anything else to find? I feel like there should be one more in there. But don't quote me on that. It's been a while. Do you have any games from Steam? I'm not honestly even sure if there's a Steam client for Mac? Which is to say no. I do all of my everything on Macs, so I usually assume that games just aren't available. So most of the games that I have are actually either from Blizzard or through Humble Bundle. I've been playing actually a lot of Hearthstone recently. It's the first game for quite a while that's actually caught my attention at all. Think the last game I gave any remotely significant amount of time play before that was probably Braid, when I got that through one of the Humble Bundles. And before that would have been like maybe World of Warcraft or Bait and Kaitos in one order or another. I think it actually is probably like WoW, Bait and Kaitos, WoW. Oh, I guess Wind Waker's in there somewhere too. But like we're talking, you know, like you can tell like as these games get a little ways back there, pretty rapidly breach like not just, you know, the current generation of consoles, but like arcing back into the distant past. There was a Steam Summer Sale recently, though people said the sales weren't as great as past summer sales. We know you don't play Metroplexity, so what games do you play? Fez and Lamulana are pretty crazy. I shudder to think if you got any puzzle ideas from those games. I test Metroplexity, but I don't, you know, play it in any sort of normal sense. It's the same thing with Twilight Heroes. Like I said, I've been playing, I don't actually play it, a ton of games, just in general. I do actually way more reading on games than playing them. I've been playing Hearthstone a lot. Really like the arena in Hearthstone, which is sort of their draft equivalent. And not just because I'm really, really good at it. Totally not biased. I don't think I'm actually entirely biased. Like, it's a really sweet bit of design that I also, you know, happen to be really good at. I sort of ended up accidentally listing a bunch of the ones before. I even have a lot of, like, games that I have from Humble Bundles that I've never actually gotten around to playing. And even, like, console games. Like, we have Kirby Canvas Curse, I think? One of the newer Kirby games for DS. I've just never gotten around to playing it. And we have... we don't have any of the modern... I mean, we don't have a Wii U, PS4, or X-Bone. I guess this is sort of a tale to explain how Liz and I interact with games. It is not strange for us to play Kirby Air Ride. We play it not infrequently. Maybe a couple of times a month sort of thing, but more than we play most games, obviously. Let me see when this game was actually released. It was originally for the GameCube. It was released in 2003. So over a decade ago now. we still not infrequently play that. And Liz is going through her maybe fifth run through Twilight Princess right now. Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. I guess the moral of the story here is that when we decide to play a game, it's just sort of like a death grip. And I guess falling into that, probably the game we play the most of is actually Pathfinder, being obviously a tabletop role-playing game rather than a computer game, but we've played that a lot. But even, like, role-playing games that I consider sort of, like, minor side things, I tend to play a lot more of than... I'll give time to most video games. So, like, Shadowrun, which I have never played a ton of, but is still one of the, you know, major forces behind Metroplexity. I've still played more of that than, you know, the Metroid series, right? Like, we own a bunch of Metroid games, but, like, we've never really invested in them. So, yeah. So yeah, mostly role-playing games. I guess the other important part of understanding how I game is I actually, a lot of games I will just watch Liz play, because Liz is really good at video games. But so, like, I'll just watch Liz, like, annihilate Twilight Princess for the fifth time. I mean, I was about to say the first time that she didn't, you know, annihilate it, but she pretty much did. Like, Liz plus Legend of Zelda game usually ends up meaning, like, there's, like, a fairy used during the game, and, like, that's it. Like, it's... And on this playthrough, it's, like, oh, an enemy actually hurt me. That's weird. And, like, Skyward Sword, there's the... I forget what they call it now, but, like, the Master Quest version, where it's harder, and that started out okay for her, but ended up being way too easy towards the end. Things like that. And I'm not like great at video games, so I sort of outsourced most of that to Liz. But she mostly plays Legend of Zelda games, and we collectively play stuff like Air Ride and Smash Brothers. We might get a Wii U when the Smash Brothers 4 comes out. We'll see. I guess one of the other games that I've Durgan, who's a player here and also a friend of mine from job when I was working at the help desk, that I wanted to have a game to play between calls, played a bunch of Borderlands 2, and that was a lot of fun to watch. Funny game. Do you know much about Braid and its 8 stars? Amazingly difficult to acquire items in the game that took a whole community continual and focused effort in order to collect them all, which in no way in the game is even exists, so it took forever to even discover. What do you think about this game design? Do you see yourself incorporating something like that into Metroplexity? I mean, there are definitely a lot of things that have taken a lot of collective effort to figure out Metroplexity, so I think we can safely say yes, that I do like that kind of game design and have strongly considered incorporating stuff like that into Metroplexity. I'm not super familiar with the Braid situation, other than, you know, I've played it some, not really good enough at platformers to speak of, but that's the nature of things. How many cycles does the cycle chain fit into? How many deep and dark secrets is it part of, befitting its namesake? I think just one cycle. Maybe there might be a secret cycle of chain weapons. Cycle, chain, cycle, cycle? It's pretty crazy thinking about the rage effects. They're a largely ignored set of effects from the community, yet have a myriad of interactions in-game. Recently, Al just learned about rage effects and the paintings. What about rage effects got you so fascinated by them, while the rest of us steer clear? So one of the things that I think is really fascinating about sort of Metroplexity and its interaction with drugs is that one of the cornerstones of, like, really dangerous drugs, like, not like, you know, booze or caffeine or whatever, but like the stuff that'll really fuck you up, is that you will start making choices differently. And so having effects that actually change the way that your choices are made is, I think, an incredibly interesting, powerful way to represent that in-game. And with a game that is as much about choices and as much about drugs as Metroplexity, I think that's super cool. It's not a space I've gotten to explore a ton of, but that's sort of my fascination with the rage effects and related stuff in a nutshell. Speaking of little insular things, you keep adding attractions to Blitz Poppers. Added way back at the start of Gang Warfare, we have found the fingerprints of the Midgard player in Empty Heart. What makes you keep going back to this item? One of the things that I do quite a bit is... Well, I mean, some of it is a... I mean, a lot of stuff cross-links. I mean, the... It's... weirder for me to include, like, a technique, or especially if I'm, like, scripting something out, that doesn't have hooks into other stuff. But one of the other things that I do, sort of consciously, is if there's something that people haven't figured out, I try to keep it updated, for two reasons. One of them being, people will tell me if there's an interaction that I'm missing, if they know what both elements of the interaction are, right? So if, you know, the secret, you know, giant sea serpent fight in, like, Metroplex, for example, a purely hypothetical example, if, you know, there's something with the cycle chain that should interact with that, you know, to, you know, wrap around the serpent's neck and strangle it or whatever, like you do. Actually, for the sake of the example, we should probably make it a giant lion with invulnerable skin and choking with the chain. We'll go for that. So, if you have the, you know, the giant lion fight beneath the ghoul warehouse, and I add in the chain, and it's like, well, all of the, like, other chains let you strangle it. Like, what's wrong with this chain? It should totally work with the charm chain. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, duh, you're right, obviously. I put that in there. And then, but if, you know, the lion was particularly well hidden, in, you know, say some tall grass somewhere, then nobody would know to tell me that I'd fucked something up, right, by not adding the interaction. So, there's that half of it. The other half of it is, the more things cross-linked like that, it acts both sort of as a, in some cases, actually, like, additional pointers into the puzzle. Like, oh, there should totally be a way to, you know, make myself, you know, invulnerable to, you know, walk through the lake of fire. It's like, well, you have to, you know, kill and skin the giant lion in the tall grass and, you know, Metroplex the university's campus. People are like, ah, but how can I get into the lake of fire? And it's like, well, maybe there will be a reference back to, you know, the giant lion in there somewhere. Whatever. Or, also, it sort of ups the ante. So if there's something that people are having a lot of trouble figuring out, a lot of times, I mean, I'll make a chunk of content and I'll throw in, like, you know, say 10 interactions that I think are appropriate. People find 5 of them really quickly. Obviously, you know, those were the easy ones. And, you know, the other, like, you know, 3 or 4 will get picked off over the course of, you know, the upcoming months or year or whatever. But if there's one that's still sitting there and just being like, wow, I made this puzzle way more challenging than, like, I really thought about, let's up the reward there, right? It's like, oh, well, there's this interaction that lets you get, like, you know, a buff for a little while. Well, you know, if it's that hard to figure out, maybe that buff should also, you know, let you kill the giant lion, or, you know, walk through the fire, or, you know, do, you know, whatever the buff should do. So there's where a lot of places where there are weird interactions, they'll actually gain more and more interactions over time. And it's sort of a... Just in general, that sort of webbing, I think, improves the game. I'm not sure 100% whether, like, how much it should have, like, those nexuses, or if everything should be interlinked sort of more loosely, if that makes sense. Because, like, there are definitely things that, like, you know, like, 5 or 10 different things to interact with, right? Individually, you know, this buff, you know, interacting with this thing, or this other thing will, you know, do whatever. And so, but I'm not sure in general if you get, like, a... If it should be intentionally more, more sort of, not sparse isn't the right word, more evenly spread. So it's like instead of most things having one connection and a few things having like 5 to 10, feel like all of them having 2 connections would be better. Personally, I think that the way that it ends up working actually feels more organic. So I go with that. Also, it just, some things will just catch my eye. I mean, obviously you can, speak to this to some extent. The, there'll be places where there don't even need to be interactions, really. Like, there's, like, all of this fishing stuff. And fishing doesn't need to be that interesting, right? But I think it's fun. So it gets a whole bunch of stuff. And a lot of that stuff links to all this other stuff. So, yeah. Why so many suspicious things in this game? Or is it just me? A lot of suspicious things. Sometimes it's hint, sometimes it's just me trying to describe something. I might just use the word suspicious a lot. I think my suspicious count in item names is probably less than the heart count. Which I remember Al doing at one point. And a lot of hearts. I'm totally not counting the artichoke hearts, though. That one's not my fault. Okay, I'm done. Is it 2 hours yet? Mission failed! 1 hour 47 minutes. Sorry to disappoint. We do still have a couple questions from Velmo, though, so there is some hope. Already a lot of questions, so I'll try to keep this short. Some of them are going to be long, unfortunately. The first few contain to fishing at the hidden fishing spot on the waterfront. Are bait bluegills a possible result? Going off my data, I only have 1 bait bluegill out of 229 trips, so I may have logged a lake bluegill incorrectly. The bait being sparse makes sense, though, as if a lot of the other fish are around, they'd probably be eating the bait bluegills. I want to say that you can't get the bait ones at the special fishing spot. No. In general, with that many trials, unless something is, like, specifically unlocked, you'd have almost assuredly found it by that point. So I would guess, and you would have, like, a decent number of them. So I would say it's probably, yeah, what you were thinking, that you had mislogged it. I'm also having a hard time correctly logging when I find any of the extra items. I know it is possible to get 2 extra items in one trip in the form of a lost hook and a piece of high-test line, because of a few trips when I had 5 standard results along with the line and hook. The issue I'm hitting with logging is discerning the origin of any high-test line that I find. For example, with 3 dock pikes, a piece of high-test line, and a lost hook, I know the lost hook is an extra item, but I can't pin down if the high test line is an extra item or a regular result. Yeah, there is not going to be a super easy way to tell that. So you can definitely tell if there are extra items, but determining for sure if a particular item is extra or not is not the easiest thing in the world to do. Additionally, would you be willing to give a hint as to how the extra items are handled? I know it can be a piece of line, a hook, a rod, or a hook plus line. Are duplicate of the same items possible, like two lines? As far as the bonus items, no, I think you've got the exact results. And it sort of, I think it sort of follows. Like, you're really just, you're fishing up one item, effectively. It's just sometimes the line has hook attached to it. Lastly, are the extra items supposed to be influenced by fishing modifiers? Plus 40 fishing for 116 trips resulted in 100 extra items, which could positively ID as extras, and plus 3 surface for 113 trips resulted in 33 extra I could ID as such. There are a lot of things in fishing that are influenced by those modifiers. They do have a baseline effect, which I think you have done quite a bit of work figuring out, but they also, almost any fishing-related special thing ends up playing into those in one way or another. Like, a lot of effects, it'll just be like, you know, if you are going for objects sometimes, like, entire categories will go away, things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of interactions with fishing modifiers in general. Just one another question for you this time around. Aside from fun little trinkets that can help smooth out our combat chance with the Charm Chain, do they have a function left to be found? They're pretty interesting as is, but I'm still curious. They are definitely primarily intended for the sort of saving stuff for the Charm Chain, and obviously they have their bonuses as well. Okay, looks like we are narrowing down on the 2-hour mark. I think I have talked about everything I intended, both sort of the scheduling stuff with new unearthly item coming out when I get it done, the Novos stuff upcoming, which is looking pretty good, the possible maybe delays on the art front rippling through to other stuff, with Puyo's friend being in town. Talked a bunch about cons, which I guess I didn't really intend to do. And I think we hit on just generally the high points. So I guess that's it. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks for playing, asking questions, and obviously for donating. I will be signing off now, but I will be back for podcast 38. This time it's not podcast 37. Old strong bad joke is old. Okay. Have a good one.